She's in the red, and she's in it deep. And she answers to me, damn it, not to you, and certainly not to Lydia bloody Wells. But what do you mean, won't answer to the name of whore?
Just that, said Edgar Clinch. She's done with the profession. So she says.
Mannering's face had turned purple.
You can't just walk out on your own job. I don't care if you're a whore, or a butcher, or a bloody baker. You can't just walk out. Not when there's a debt outstanding.
That's the...
In mourning, she said,
Mannering cried, leaping up.
For a time, she said. Give a girl an inch and she takes a bloody mile. Not on my watch, all right? Not with £100 against her name. No, indeed.
Clinch was looking at the magnate coldly.
She said to tell you that Aubert Gascoigne has the money for you, he said. She said to tell you that it's hidden underneath his bed.
Who in hell is Aubert Gascoigne?
He's a clerk at the magistrate's court, Clinch said. He filed the widow's appeal on Crosby Wells' fortune.
Aha, said Mannering. So we're coming back around to that, are we? Well, I'll be goddamned.
There's another thing, Clinch said. Mr. Gascoigne was up in Hannah's room this afternoon, and shots were fired. 2 shots. I asked him about it afterwards, and he countered by mentioning the debt. I went up to look. There's a hole in Hannah's pillow, right through the middle. The stuffing came out.
2 holes?
Just one.
And the widow saw it,
Mannering said.
No, Clinch said. She came later. But when Mr. Gascoigne left, he did say that he was going to talk to a lady, and then she showed up about 2 hours after that.
What's the other fortune?
Mannering said suddenly.
You said there was another fortune. I thought...
Clinch dropped his gaze.
No, it doesn't matter. I made a mistake. Forget it.
Mannering was frowning.
What obligation does Lydia Wells have to pay off Anna's debt? He said. Where's her profit there?
I don't know, Clinch said. But the two of them seemed very intimate this afternoon.
Intimate? That's not a profit.
I don't know, Clinch said again.
They were on each other's arms. They were in good spirits. What?
Yes, said Clinch. They were linked at the elbow. And when the widow spoke, Anna leant in close.
He fell silent, dwelling on the memory.
And you let her go?
Mannering barked suddenly.
You let her go without asking me, without calling me over. She's my best girl, Edgar. You know that without me telling you. The others aren't a patch on Anna.
I could hardly have detained her, Clinch said, looking sour. What would I have done? Locked her up? And anyway, you were in Canieri.
Mannering leapt up from his chair.
So Chinaman's Anne is no longer any man's Anne.
He thumped his hat on his leg.
She makes it seem altogether simple, does she not? Quitting her profession. As if we could all just wake up one morning and decide.
But Edgar Clinch did not care to pursue this rhetorical line. He was meditating sorrowfully upon the fact that tomorrow was Sunday, and the first Sunday in many months when he did not have the drawing of Anna's bath to look forward to. Aloud, he said, "Maybe you ought to go and speak to Mr. Gascoigne about that money."
"Do you know what makes me angry, Edgar?"
Mannering said.
"Second-hand news makes me angry. Picking up after other men makes me angry. Hearing all this from you, it makes me angry. What does Anna want me to do? Knock on the door of a man I barely know? What would I say? Excuse me, sir, I believe there's a great deal of money under your bed, and Anna Wetherill owes it to me. It's disrespectful. Disrespectful is what it is. No, as far as I'm concerned, that girl is still in my employ. She is still very much a whore, and her debt to me is still very much unpaid."
Clinch nodded. His energy had dissipated, and he wanted now to be alone. He picked up the banknote, folded it, and placed it inside his wallet against his heart. "What time did you say for the meeting tonight?"
"Sundown," said Mannering. "Only you might want to arrive before or after, so we're not all trooping in at once.
You'll find a fair clutch of men have come out of this business feeling like there's someone to blame.
Can't say I care for the crown, said Clinch, half to himself. They skimped on glass, I think. The frontage windows ought to be wider, and there ought to be a roof over the porch.
Well, it'll be quiet, and that's all that matters.
Yes.
Mannering put his hat on.
If you'd asked me last week who was to blame for all of this madness, I would have guessed the Jew. If you'd asked me yesterday, I would have guessed the widow. This afternoon, I would have told you Chinaman. And now? Well, Edgar, I'm damned if I don't lay my money on that whore. You mark my words. Anna Wetherill knows exactly why that money turned up at Crosby Wells, and she knows exactly what happened to Emery Staines. God rest his soul, though I do speak prematurely. Attempted suicide, my hat. Morning dress, my hat. She's into the teeth with Lydia Wells. And together, they're up to something.
Suk Yong Sheng and Kui Long stamped down the Canyeri Road towards Hokitika, identically clad in wide-brimmed felt hats, woolen capes, and canvas overshoes. Dusk was falling, bringing with it a rapid drop in temperature and turning the standing water at the roadside from brown to glossy blue. There was little traffic, save for the infrequent cart or lone rider making for the warmth and light of the town ahead, still some 2 miles distant, though one could hear the roar of the ocean already, a dull, pitchless sound, and above it the infrequent cry of a seabird, the call floating thin and weightless above the sound of the rain. The two men were conversing in Cantonese.
"There is no gold in the Aurora,"
Ah Kui was saying.
"Can you be certain?"
"The claim is barren. It is as if the earth has been already turned."
"Turned earth can be surprising," replied Ah Suk. "I know of many men who make their livings out of tailing piles."
"You know of many Chinese men who make their livings out of tailing piles,"
Ah Kui corrected.
"And then they are beaten, even killed, by those men whose eyes were not as sharp."
"Money is a burden," said Ah Suk.
This was a proverb he quoted often.
"A burden that is felt most keenly by the poor," said Ah Kui.
He glanced sidelong at the other man.
"Your trade has also been slow of late."
"It has," said Ah Suk evenly.
"The whore has lost her taste for the smoke."
"Yes, I cannot account for it."
"Perhaps she has found an alternate supplier."
"Perhaps."
"You do not believe that?"
"I do not know what to believe."
"You are suspicious of the chemist."
"Yes, among other men."
Ah Kui mused a moment and then said,
"I do not think that the fortune I uncovered ever belonged to Anna herself."
"No,"
Ah Suk agreed.
"That is likely. After all, she did not remark its theft."
Ah Kui glanced at him.
"Do you think of my action as a theft?"
"I do not wish to impugn your honor,"
Ah Suk began, but then he hesitated.
"Your implication goes against your wish, Suk Yong Sheng."
Ah Suk ducked his head.
"Forgive me. I am ignorant, and my ignorance shines brighter than my intent."
"Even ignorant men have opinions," said Ah Kui. "Tell me, am I a thief to you?"
"It is the wish for secrecy that defines a theft,"
the hatter said at last, somewhat lamely.
"In saying so, you impugn the honour of more men than me."
"If I speak untruly, I will swallow back my words."
"You speak untruly,"
Ah Kui snapped.
"When a man finds a nugget on the goldfields, he does not proclaim it. He hides it, and speaks nothing to his fellows. Here on the goldfields, every man has a wish for secrecy. Only a fool speaks of his discoveries aloud. You would be no different, Suk Yong Sheng, if you came upon a pile."
"But the gold you speak of was not discovered on the field,"
Ah Suk said.
"You found your fortune in a woman's pocket. You took it from her person, not from the ground."
"The woman had no knowledge of what she carried.
She was like a man who camps beside a river rich in gold and sees nothing, suspects nothing. But the gold in a river does not belong to anyone, nor does it belong to the river. You have said yourself that the gold could not have belonged to Anna. Not to Anna. But what of the tailor's claim upon it? What of the tailor's purpose in hiding such a sum in the folds of a woman's gown? I had no knowledge of the tailor, said Arqui hotly. When you come upon a silver penny, do you ask who forged it? No, you ask only who touched that penny last. I am not a thief for taking something that was lost.
Lost?
Lost, said Arqui. That fortune had been claimed by no one. It had been stolen before me, and it has been stolen since.
Forgive me, said Arsuk.
I stand corrected. A whore is not a concubine, said Arqui.
He was getting worked up. Evidently this was a subject on which he had desired to defend himself for some time.
A whore cannot become respectable. A whore cannot become rich. All the prestige and all the profit belong to the whoremonger, never to the whore. Yes, the only one who truly profits from her trade is the man who stands behind her, purse in one hand, pistol in the other. I did not steal from Anna. What could I have stolen? She owns nothing. That gold was never hers.
They heard hoofbeats behind them and turned. A pair of riders, both sitting very low in the saddle, were heading for Hokitika at a canter. Both horses were in a lather, and both riders were making very free with their crops to urge them still faster. The Chinese men stood aside to let them pass.
"Forgive me," said Arsuk again when they were gone. "I was mistaken. You are not a thief, Kuilong."
They resumed walking.
"Mr. Staines is the true thief," said the goldsmith. "He stole with intent, and then fled without compunction. I was foolish to place my trust in him."
"Staines is in league with Francis Carver," said Arsuk. "The Aurora's records prove as much. That alliance is reason enough to doubt his worth."
Arqui glanced across at his companion.
"I do not know your Francis Carver," he said. "I have never heard his name before today."
"He is a merchant trader," said Arsuk, without expression. "I knew him in Guangzhou as a boy. He betrayed my family, and I have sworn to take his life."
"This much I know already," said Arqui. "I should like to know more."
"It is a pitiful story."
"Then I will listen with compassion. A betrayal of any of my countrymen is a betrayal of me."
Arsuk frowned at this.
"The betrayal is mine to avenge," he said.
"I meant only that we must help each other, Suk Yongsheng."
"Why do you say must?"
"Chinese life is cheap in this country."
"All life is cheap upon a goldfield."
"You are wrong," said Arqui. "Today you saw a man strike me, pull my hair, insult me, and threaten me with death, all without consequence. And there will be no consequence. Every man in Hokitika would sooner take Mannering's part than mine. And why? Because I am Chinese, and he is not Chinese. You and I must help each other, Arsuk. We must. The law is united against us. We must have the means to unite against the law."
This was a sentiment that Arsuk had never heard expressed. He was silent for a time, digesting it. Arqui took off his hat, struck it several times with his palm, and replaced it on his head. Somewhere in the bush nearby, a bellbird gave its lusty, open-throated cry. The call was taken up by another, and another, and for a moment the trees around them were alive with song. It was by preference, and not by necessity, that Suk Yongsheng lived and worked alone. He was not surly by temperament, and in fact did not find it difficult to form friendships, nor to allow those friendships to deepen once they had been formed. He simply preferred to answer to himself. He disliked all burdens of responsibility, most especially when those responsibilities were expected or enforced, and friendship, in his experience, nearly always devolved into matters of debt, guilt, and expectation. Those men he did choose to call his intimates were those who demanded nothing and gave much. As a consequence, there were many charitable figures in Arsuk's past, and very few upon whom he had expressly doted. He had the sensibility of a social vanguard, unattached, full of conviction, and, in his own perception at least, almost universally misunderstood. The sense of being constantly undervalued by the world at large would develop over time into a kind of private demagoguery. He was certain of the comprehensive scope of his own vision, and rarely thought it necessary to explain himself to other men. In general, his beliefs were projections of a simpler, better world, in which he liked fantastically to dwell. For he preferred the immaculate fervour of his own solitude to all other social obligations, and tended, when in company, to hold himself aloof. Of this propensity he was not at all unaware, for he was highly reflexive, and given to extensive self-analysis of the most rigorous and contemplative kind. But he analysed his own mind as a prophet analyses his own strange visions, that is, with reverence, and believing always that he was destined to be the herald of a cosmic raison d'etre, a universal plan.
"My history with Francis Carver," he said at last, "is a story with many beginnings, but I hope that it will only have one end."
"Tell it," said Arqui.
Harold Nielsen closed the door of his quayside office, sat down at his desk, and without first removing his hat or his coat, penned a hasty note to Joseph Pritchard. The tone of his letter was frantic, even slovenly, but Nielsen did not care to revise it. Without rereading his words, he blotted the page, folded the paper, and stamped the sealing wax with the circular matrix of Nielsen & Co. He then summoned Albert and instructed the boy to deliver the note to Pritchard's drug emporium on Collingwood Street post-haste. Once Albert had departed, Nielsen hung up his hat, exchanged his rain-soaked coat for a dry robe, and reached for his pipe. But even after the tobacco was lit, and he had sat down, put up his feet, and crossed his ankles, he did not feel reassured. He felt chilly. His skin was damp to the touch, and the rhythm of his heart would not slow. He stuck the pipe in the corner of his mouth, as he liked to do, and turned his attention to the subject of his disquiet, the promise he had made earlier that day to George Shepherd, governor of the Hokitika jail. Nielsen wondered whether he ought to break his vow of silence and share the details of Shepherd's proposition with the assembly that evening. The matter was certainly relevant to their prospective discussion, principally for the reason that it concerned a percentage of Crosby Wells' fortune, but also because, Nielsen suspected, Shepherd's antipathy towards the politician Lauderback was not just a matter of convict labour, jailhouses and roads. When one considered that the politician Alistair Lauderback had been the first to encounter Crosby Wells' dead body, well, Nielsen thought, it was clear that Governor Shepherd was as mixed up in the Crosby Wells conspiracy as the rest of them. But how much did Shepherd know? And whom was he serving beyond his own self-interest? Had he known about the fortune hidden in Crosby Wells' cottage? Had Lauderback known about it, for that matter? Brooding, Nielsen recrossed his ankles and repositioned his pipe at his mouth, cupping the bowl between the crook of his index finger and the pad of his thumb. Whichever way one looked at it, he thought, there was no denying that George Shepherd knew a great deal more than he was letting on. Harold Nielsen was used to commanding public attention, an authority he achieved through the use of wit, declamation, and comical self-styling. He became very quickly bored when he was required, for whatever reason, to inhabit the periphery of a crowded room. His vanity required constant stimulation, and constant proof that the ongoing creation of his selfhood was a project that he himself controlled. He was vexed now to think that he had been played as a fool. Not because he believed himself undeserving of such treatment. Nielsen knew very well that he was an impressionable type, and often joked about this very fact, but because he could not perceive Shepherd's motivation in having treated him so. He puffed at his pipe, conjuring in his mind the prospective jailhouse, the asylum, the scaffold of the gallows built high above the drop. All of it would be built with his commission and by his leave. Hang Governor Shepherd, he thought suddenly. He had no real obligation to keep Shepherd's secret. Why, he did not even know exactly what that secret really was. He would share Shepherd's request with the Assembly that evening, and he would share his own suspicions about the man to boot. He was not yet contractually bound to keep his silence. He had not yet signed his name to any document. What did that matter anyway? A jailhouse was not a private property. It belonged to all of Hokitika. A jailhouse was built by the government, and on behalf of the adherents of the law. Presently, Nielsen heard the door in the outer office open and close. He leapt up. It was Albert, returning from Joseph Pritchard's drug hall. His jacket was very wet, and when he stepped into Nielsen's office, he carried with him the earthy smell of rain.
"Did he burn the letter?" Nielsen said anxiously. "Did you watch him burn it? What's that you got there?"
"Pritchard's reply," said Albert. He held up a folded piece of paper.
"I said there wasn't to be a reply. I said that."
"Yes," said Albert, "and I told him, but he pinned one anyway."
Nielsen eyed the document in Albert's hand.
"Did he burn my letter, at least?"
"Yes,"
Albert said, but then he hesitated.
"What? What?"
"Well," Albert said, "when I said he had to burn it, he laughed."
Nielsen narrowed his eyes.
"Why did he laugh?"
"I don't know," said Albert, "but I thought I should tell you that he did. Maybe it doesn't matter."
The muscle beneath Nielsen's eye began to pulse.
"He laughed when he read the letter? When he read the words?"
"No," said Albert. "He only laughed before, when I said he had to burn it."
"He found it amusing, did he?"
"That you told him to burn it,"
said Albert, nodding. He was fingering the edges of the letter in his hand. He wanted very much to ask his employer what all of this to-do was on account of, but he did not know how to ask without risking a rebuke. Aloud, he said,
"Do you want to read the reply?"
Nielsen held out his hand.
"Here," he said. "You didn't read it, did you?"
"No,"
Albert said, looking wounded.
"It's sealed."
"Oh, yes, so it is," said Nielsen.
He took the note from Albert's hand, turned it over, and broke apart the seal with his fingers.
"What are you waiting for?"
he said, before he unfolded the paper.
"You can go."
"Home?"
said Albert, in a voice of great regret.
"Yes, home, you idiot,"
said Nielsen.
"And you can leave the key on the desk before you do."
But the boy lingered.
"On the way back," he said, "when I passed the Prince of Wales, I saw there's a new show opening tonight, a foreign spectacle. Mr. Mannering's given away tickets for free on account of the opening, and I got one for you."
He had spoken all of this very quickly. Now he screwed up his face and looked away. Nielsen had not yet unfolded Pritchard's letter.
"What?"
he said.
"Sensations from the Orient,"
the boy said.
"It's a gallery ticket, front and centre, the best. I asked for it special." "You use it yourself," Nielsen said. "You go yourself. I don't want a ticket to the theatre. Get along now."
The boy scuffed his shoe upon the boards.
"I got myself one too," he said. "I thought, seeing as it's Saturday, and the races have been postponed."
Nielsen shook his head.
"I can't go to the theatre tonight," he said.
"Oh,"
said Albert.
"Why?"
"I'm feeling poorly."
"Just for the first act,"
the boy said.
"There's supposed to be champagne. Champagne's good if you're feeling poorly."
"Take Henry Fuller with you."
"By the player's door, I saw a lady with a parasol."
"Take Henry."
"She was Japanese,"
said Albert mournfully.
"It didn't look like grease paint. It looked like she was really Japanese. Henry Fuller's up the beach. Why won't you come?"
"I'm very ill."
"You don't look ill. You're smoking."
"I'm sure you can find someone to go along with you,"
Nielsen said with mounting irritation.
"Go down to the Star and wave their ticket around. How about that?"
Albert stared at the floorboards for a moment and worked his mouth. At length he sighed and said,
"Well, I expect I'll see you on Monday, Mr. Nielsen."
"Yes, I expect you will, Albert."
"Goodbye."
"Goodbye. You'll have to tell me all about the show, all right?"
"Maybe
we can go again, Albert said. Only the tickets for tonight, but maybe we can go again.
Yes, Nielsen said.
Next week, perhaps, after I recover.
He waited until the disappointed subordinate had padded from the room and closed the door quietly behind him. Then he unfolded Pritchard's letter and stepped towards the window for a better light. H. Can confirm. But listen, something odd happened this afternoon at Anna's. Pistols involved. Will explain in full in person. Events witnessed by A.G., courthouse clerk. Perhaps you should speak to him if you're playing the detective. Whatever Anna's mixed up in, I'm sure that A.G. knows about it. Do you trust him? Can't say that I do. Well, the jury's still out, as the saying goes. Destroy this letter. J.S.P. Thomas Balfour had returned in the late afternoon to the Palace Hotel with the intention of finding Cowell Devlin, the chaplain who had overheard his conversation with Lauderback that morning. He wished to apologise for his earlier rudeness, but also, and rather more urgently, to ask the chaplain about his connection to the vanished prospector Emery Staines. He was sure that Devlin's inquiry at the office of the West Coast Times was connected somehow to the Crosby Wells affair. Devlin was not at the Palace Hotel, however. The kitchen staff informed Balfour that he had left the dining room several hours before. He was not in his tent upon the beachfront, nor at the police camp jailhouse, nor in any of the churches. He was not in any of the stores or billiard halls, and he was not on the quay. Balfour wandered about Hokitika for several hours, dejected, and was about to give up and go home when he spied Devlin at last. The chaplain was walking down Revel Street, his hat and coat quite saturated. Walking next to him was another man, a good deal taller and larger than he. Balfour crossed the street. He was already raising his arm to flag the other down when he recognised Devlin's companion. It was the Maori man with whom he had also spoken earlier that day, and to whom he had also been rather unforgivably rude.
"Hi there," he called. "Reverend Devlin, would you believe it? The very man I was looking to find. Hello, Ted. I'm glad to see you again, too."
Taufari did not offer a greeting. Devlin, however, smiled.
"I see that you have found out my surname," he said. "I am afraid I still do not know yours."
Balfour thrust out his hand.
"Tom Balfour," he said, beaming, and they shook hands. "Yes, I went to see Ben Lerventhal over at the Times, and we had some words about you. Matter of fact, I've been trying to track you down these past few hours to ask you something."
"Then our meeting is doubly fortuitous," said Devlin.
"It's a question about Emery Staines," Balfour said, interrupting him. "I hear you've been asking after him, you see, wanting to know who placed that notice in the paper advertising his return. Ben told me that you'd been by. I'm wanting to know why you're asking after him, Staines, I mean, and what's your connection to the man?"
Cowell Devlin hesitated. The truth, of course, was that Emery Staines was one of the three names written upon the deed of gift that he had taken from the ash drawer of Crosby Wells Range the day after the hermit's death. He had not showed that deed to anyone, however, and he had resolved not to do so until he knew a little more about the people it concerned. Ought he to lie to Balfour? He did not like to utter falsehoods, but perhaps he could tell a partial truth. He bit his lip. Balfour had perceived the chaplain's hesitation and had mistaken it for reproof. He put up his hands.
"Hark at me," he exclaimed, "asking questions in the street and in the weather, when we're getting wetter all the time. Look here, how about we share a meal together? Something hot. There's no sense in talking out of doors, not when there are warm hotels on either side of us and good cheer to be had."
Devlin glanced at Taufare, who, despite his dislike of Balfour, had brightened considerably at the prospect of a meal. Balfour coughed and then thumped his chest with his fist, wincing.
"Oh, I wasn't myself this morning. Out of sorts. I wasn't myself. I'm sorry for it, and I mean to make it up to both of you.
I'll stand us all a plate or something, and we'll have a drink together, as friends. Come, let a man say he's sorry when he asks.
The threesome was soon established at a corner table at Maxwell's. Balfour, who was always very happy to play the role of the munificent host, ordered 3 bowls of clear soup, a round of bread, a fat black pudding, a hard cheese, sardines in oil, hot buttered carrots, a pot of stewed oysters, and a demijohn of stout. He had the prescience to delay any talk of Crosby Wells or Emery Staines until both his guests were sated with food and drink, and talked instead of whaling, a subject of which all 3 men had a most romantic conception, and much to share. When Benjamin Löwenthal found them some 3/4 of an hour later, they were a very merry party.
"Ben!" cried Balfour, when he saw Löwenthal approaching. "But what about your Sabbath?"
He had become, for the second time that day, rather drunk.
"It's at starlight," Löwenthal said shortly.
To Taufare he said,
"I believe that we have not yet been introduced. I am Benjamin Löwenthal. I publish the West Coast Times."
"Tirao Taufare,"
the Maori man replied, and shook his hand very firmly.
"He also goes by Ted," said Balfour. "Very good friend of Crosby Wells."
"Were you?" said Löwenthal to Taufare.
"His finest friend," said Devlin. "Better than brothers," said Balfour.
"Well, in that case," said Löwenthal, "my business concerns all 3 of you."
Benjamin Löwenthal had no authority to widen the invitation to the Crown Hotel Council to include Devlin and Taufare. But, as we have observed already, Löwenthal could be very forbidding when his ethical code was affronted, and Charlie Frost had affronted him that afternoon by suggesting that the Crown Assembly ought to be restricted to an exclusive few. Löwenthal felt the need to rectify what he perceived to have been Frost's moral error, and he extended the invitation to Taufare and Devlin now as an obscure act of reproach.
"Capital," Balfour said. "Pull up a chair."
Löwenthal sat down, placed the palms of his hands together, and in a low voice explained the purpose of the meeting that evening, to which Balfour acquiesced immediately, Taufare gravely, and Cal Devlin after a long, judicious pause. The chaplain was thinking about the deed of gift that he had taken from the hermit's stove, currently stored in his Bible between the Old Testament and the New. He resolved to bring his Bible with him to the council that evening, and to produce the deed if the occasion moved him, and the timing was right. There was smoke issuing from Gascoigne's chimney, and upon Mannering's knock, the door opened promptly, and Gascoigne peered out. He was holding a freshly lit cigarette, and had exchanged his formal jacket for shirt sleeves and a woolen vest.
"Yes," he said.
"I have it on good information that you're holding on to some money," Dick Mannering said. "That money's mine, and I've come to collect it."
Robert Gascoigne looked at him, then put his cigarette to his lips, inhaled, and blew a stream of smoke over Mannering's shoulder into the rain.
"Who is the source of your good information?" he said mildly.
"Miss Anna Wetherill, by way of Mr. Edgar Clinch," Mannering said.
Gascoigne leant against the doorframe.
"And how did Miss Anna Wetherill, by way of Mr. Edgar Clinch, imagine that you would act upon receiving this good information?"
"Don't play clever with me," Mannering said. "Don't do it. I'll only tell you once. I don't like cleverness one bit. She says the money's hidden under your bed."
Gascoigne shrugged.
"Well, if I am holding a fortune for Anna," he said, "I'm doing it on promise, and see no reason why I should break that promise and hand the money over to another man, just because he claims the money belongs to him. She certainly did not tell me to expect a visitor."
"It does belong to me."
"How so?"
"It's a debt," Mannering said. "She owes me."
"A debt is a private business," Gascoigne said.
"A debt can be made public very easily. How would you like it if I spread the word that you were holding on to more than £100 in pure?" Let me tell you, by midnight your door would be beaten down. By dawn the thief would be 50 miles away, and by this time tomorrow you'd be dead. Why, there'd be nothing easier, when you've no allegiances to speak of, and you live alone.
Gascoigne's expression darkened.
I am the custodian of that gold, and I will not hand it over without Miss Wetherill's consent.
Mannering smiled.
I'm going to take that as an admission of guilt.
And I'm going to take that as proof of your logical inadequacy, Gascoigne said. Good night. If Anna wants her money, she can come for it herself.
He made to close the door, but Mannering stepped forward and put out his hand, halting him.
Strange, isn't it?
He said. Gascoigne scowled.
What is strange?
Strange how a common whore suddenly fronts up with gold enough to pay the sum total of her obligations, and then hides that sum total beneath the bed of a man who's been in Ocotica barely long enough to learn her name.
It is excessively strange.
Perhaps I ought to introduce myself.
I know who you are, Gascoigne said, and I know what you do.
Mannering unbuttoned his coat to reveal his pistols.
Do you know what these are? And do you know what they do?
Yes, said Gascoigne coolly. Those are percussion revolvers, and they can each fire 6 rounds in 6 seconds flat.
7 rounds, actually, said Mannering. Second issue, Smith & Wesson's. 7 rounds each. But 6 seconds is right.
Gascoigne took another draught of his cigarette. Mannering placed his hands upon his holsters, smiling.
I must ask you to invite me into your home, Mr. Gascoigne.
The Frenchman did not reply, but after a moment he crushed the end of his cigarette on the doorframe, dropped it, stepped to the side, and gestured with exaggerated courtesy for Mannering to enter. Mannering glanced to the corners of the room, letting his gaze linger pointedly on Gascoigne's bed. Once Gascoigne had closed the door behind him, he rounded on his host and said,
Who has your loyalty?
I am not sure I understand the question, Gascoigne said. You wish me to make a list of my friends?
Mannering glared at him.
Here's my question, he said. Does Anna have your loyalty?
Yes, Gascoigne said. Up to a point, of course.
He sat down in his striped wing-back armchair, but made no gesture to offer his guest a seat. Mannering locked his hands behind his back.
So, if you knew that she was mixed up in something, you wouldn't tell me?
Well, it would depend on the situation, of course, Gascoigne said. What kind of something are you talking about?
Are you lying on her behalf?
I agreed to conceal a pile of money on her behalf, Gascoigne said. I hid it underneath my bed. But you already know all about that, so I suppose the answer is no.
Why does she have your loyalty? Up to a point.
Gascoigne's wrists were limp upon the armrests. He had arranged himself casually, like a king in a throne. He explained that he had cared for Anna when she was released from jail 2 weeks prior, and had thereafter courted her friendship. He pitied her, for he believed that someone was using her for ill, but he could not say that he enjoyed any special intimacy with her, and had never paid to enjoy her company. The black dress, he added, had belonged to his late wife. He had given it to the whore as a gesture of charity, for her whoring gown had been ruined during her sojourn in jail. He had not expected that she would enter a period of mourning upon acquiring the dress, and in truth had been rather disappointed by this eventuation, for he thought her a very fine specimen of her sex, and would have very much liked to have taken his pleasure in the conventional way.
"Your story doesn't account for that gold underneath your bed,"
Mannering said. Gascoigne shrugged. He felt too tired and too angry to lie.
"The morning after Crosbie Wells died," he said, "Anna woke up in jail with a great quantity of gold stashed about her person. The metal had been sewn around her corset. She had no idea how she had come to be in possession of such a sum, and was naturally quite frightened. She requested my help. I thought it best to hide it, for we did not know who had hidden the gold on her body or for what purpose. We have not yet had it valued, but I would hazard its total worth at well over £100, and in all likelihood a great deal more. That, Mr. Mannering, is the whole truth, at least as far as I am concerned."
Mannering was quiet. This explanation did not make any sense to him at all.
"I must say," Gascoigne added, "you do me a great disservice by assuming my guilt before you have queried me on the subject of my innocence. I resent very much that you have trespassed upon my time and my privacy in such a belligerent way."
"You can leave off with that kind of talk," Mannering said. "Belligerent? Have I pointed a firearm in your face? Have I threatened you with violence?"
"You have not, and yet I would be happier if you were to take off your belt."
"Take it off?"
Mannering looked contemptuous.
"And lay it down in the middle of the table, I suppose, with each of us an equal distance away, until you make a move for it and I'm too slow. I won't fall for it. I've seen that trick before."
"Then I will make another request," Gascoigne said. "I request that your presence in my house is of as short a duration as possible. If you have further questions, you ought to make them now. But I have told you everything I know about that gold."
"Listen,"
Mannering said firmly. He was rather bewildered that he had so swiftly lost the upper hand.
"I didn't mean for us to start off on the wrong foot."
"Certainly you meant it," said Gascoigne. "Perhaps now you regret it, but you meant it."
Mannering swore.
"I don't regret anything," he cried. "I don't regret anything at all."
"That accounts for your serenity."
"Let me tell you something," Mannering said,
but he was prevented from saying anything further. Just at that moment came a smart rap upon the door. Gascoigne stood immediately. Mannering, who looked suddenly alarmed, stepped back several paces and withdrew one of his pistols from its holster. He held it against his thigh to conceal it from view, and nodded for Gascoigne to lift the latch. On the threshold, standing with his stick set at a rather rakish angle from his body and his hat tipped back from his brow, was Harold Nielsen. He bowed and was just about to make his introduction to Gascoigne when he perceived over the latter's shoulder Dick Mannering standing awkwardly with one arm held stiff at his side. Nielsen burst out laughing.
"Well," he said, "seems I'm two steps behind you, Dick. Everywhere I go today, there you are, and you got there first. Hello, Mr. Gascoigne. My name's Harold Nielsen. I'm very pleased to make your acquaintance. I do hope I'm not interrupting anything."
Gascoigne bowed courteously, though his expression remained cold.
"Not at all," he said. "Do come in."
"I had come to talk with you about Anna Wetherill," Nielsen said cheerfully, wiping his boots. "But I see I've been pipped at the post."
Gascoigne closed the door and said,
"What about Anna?"
At the same time, Mannering said,
"Steady up, Mr. Nielsen."
Nielsen answered Gascoigne.
"Well, it concerns something rather peculiar," he said, "so perhaps it's not for all ears. But listen, I don't want to interrupt you. I can easily come back when you're not otherwise engaged."
"No, please," Gascoigne said. "Mr. Mannering was just leaving. He just told me so himself."
It vexed Mannering to be excluded in this way.
"What's it all about?"
he said to Nielsen. Nielsen made a short bow.
"It is a very delicate situation. I do apologize."
"Hang delicate," Mannering said. "You needn't conceal anything from me, for God's sake. We're in this together. Is this about the widow? Or about the gold?"
Nielsen was uncomprehending.
"The Wells fortune?"
He turned to Gascoigne.
"Are you mixed up in that, then?"
Gascoigne was looking very amused all of a sudden.
"It seems I am being interrogated from all quarters at once," he said. "Are you also wearing pistols, Mr. Nielsen? You really ought to confess them if you are."
"I'm not wearing pistols," Nielsen said.
He glanced at Mannering and saw the revolver in his hand.
"What's that for? What are you doing?"
But Mannering did not answer. He was caught, momentarily, between all that he wished to conceal from Nielsen and all that he wished to conceal from Gascoigne. He hesitated, wishing that he had not already mentioned the widow and the gold.
"Mr. Mannering was just showing me his second issue Smith and Wesson," Gascoigne said conversationally. "That cylinder takes 7 cartridges, apparently."
"Oh," Nielsen said, but he looked suspicious. "What for?" Again, Mannering's explanation stalled in his throat. He did not wish Nielsen to know about the gold hidden beneath Gascoigne's bed, but he did not wish Gascoigne to know about the Crosby Wells debacle, and Arqui, and Arsuk, and opium, and all that was to be discussed at the Crown Hotel that very evening.
"It's a delicate situation," Gascoigne said, putting in for the older man.
He leant towards Nielsen. "All I can tell you is that Mr. Mannering here has a source of very good information in Miss Anna Wetherill, and the information comes by way of Mr. Edgar Clinch."
"That's enough out of you," said Mannering, finding his tongue at last. "Nielsen, what's your news about Anna? What's your business?"
But Nielsen misunderstood Mannering's intention in pressing him to speak upon this subject in front of Gascoigne. He remembered that Pritchard's letter had mentioned pistols and Anna, and indirectly Edgar Clinch, for Pritchard had said a strange event had taken place in Anna's room at the Gridiron Hotel that very afternoon.
Of course, Nielsen thought suddenly, their delicate situations must be one and the same. "Look here," he said, holding up his hand, "I believe we're talking about the same thing after all. If Mr. Gascoigne's in on the secret, then we may as well wait until everyone's assembled at the council and share our stories then. Save telling everything twice. Shall I see you both at the Crown?"
Mannering exhaled. "I am afraid," Gascoigne said presently, "that I am not in on the secret, and I have not been invited to a council at the Crown." There was a silence. Gascoigne looked at Nielsen, and then at Mannering. Mannering looked at Gascoigne, and then at Nielsen. Nielsen was looking at Mannering. He had a very apologetic expression upon his face.
"Now you've done it," the magnate said.
He uttered an oath, put away his pistol, and then levelled his finger at Gascoigne.
"All right," he said. "There's nothing for it, though I'm damned if your presence is welcome, and I'll be damned if I don't keep you in my sights until the evening's over and beyond. Put your coat on. You're coming along."
Mercury in Sagittarius, in which Walter Moody meditates upon the mystery at hand. We learn what happened on his journey from Dunedin, and a messenger brings unexpected news. There was a silence in the smoking room of the Crown Hotel, a silence that for a moment seemed to still the breath of every man, and still the smoke that rose in coils from the pipes, the cigarettes, the cheroots, and the cigars. It was past midnight. The darkness had rounded the corners of the room, and the cones of light cast by the spirit lamps now seemed robust and warming, where before they had been faint and chill. Strains of Saturday night filtered in from the street, an accordion, distant shouting, an infrequent whoop, hoofbeats. It had stopped raining, though the cloud had not yet cleared, and the gibbous moon showed only as a squarish patch of light in the lowering sky.
"That's it," said Thomas Balfour. "That's it. That's where we'd got to."
Moody blinked and looked around him. Balfour's narrative, disjunctive and chaotic as it was, had indeed accounted for the presence of every man in the room. There by the window was the Maori carver, Te Rau Tawhare, who had been Crosby's loyal friend in life, though he had unwittingly betrayed him at the last. There in the farthest corner was Charlie Frost, the banker who had engineered the sale of Wells' house and land, and opposite him the newspaperman Benjamin Löwenthal, who had heard about the death within mere hours of its occurrence. Edgar Clinch, purchaser of Wells' estate, was sitting on the sofa beside the billiard table, smoothing his moustache with his finger and thumb. There by the fire was Dick Mannering, whoremonger, theatre owner, and close associate of Emery Staines. There behind him was Arqui, his enemy. There, with a cue in his hand, was the commission merchant Harold Nielsen, who had discovered in Crosby Wells' cottage not only an enormous fortune, but a corked phial of laudanum, half empty, which had been purchased at Joseph Pritchard's drug hall. The latter, of course, was sitting nearest Moody. On his other side was Thomas Balfour, lackey to the politician Lauderback, whose shipping crate had lately disappeared. There, in the wing-back armchair next to Balfour, was Aubert Gascoigne, who had paid Anna Wetherill's bail and had uncovered another, smaller fortune hoarded in her orange whoring gown. Behind him was Ah Suk, peddler of opium, keeper of the den at Canieri, and former associate of Francis Carver, who had discovered that very afternoon that Crosby Wells had once been rich. And there, finally, leaning against the billiard table with his arms folded across his chest, was the chaplain Cowell Devlin, who had committed the hermit's body to its final resting place upon the terrace at Sea View. It was, in Moody's estimation, a confoundedly peripheral gathering. The 12 men were united only by their association to the events of the 14th of January, upon which night Anna Wetherill had nearly died, Crosby Wells had died, Emery Staines had vanished, Francis Carver had sailed away, and Alistair Lauderback had arrived in town. It struck Moody that none of these people were present. The jail warden, Governor Shepherd, was likewise absent, as was the crafty widow, Lydia Wells. Another thought struck Moody. The night of the 14th of January was the very evening that he himself had first set foot upon New Zealand soil. Disembarking the packet steamer that had conveyed him from Liverpool to Dunedin, he had cast his gaze skyward and had felt for the first time the strangeness of where he was. The skies were inverted, the patterns unfamiliar, the pole star beneath his feet quite swallowed. At first he searched for it stupidly, wanting to measure his present latitude from the incline of his rigid arm, as he had done as a boy on the other side of the earth. He found Orion, upended, his quiver beneath him, his sword hanging upward from his belt. Carnis Major hanging like a dead dog from a butcher's hook. There was something very sad about it, Moody thought. It was as if the ancient patterns had no meaning here. At length he found the southern crux, and tried to recall the rule for locating the pole, for there was no equivalent star to mark it here in the black of the Antipodes, where everything was upended and unformed. Did one use the crossbar of the thing? Or the spar? He could not remember. There was some kind of formula, the length of a knuckle, some equation, a matter of inches. It had bothered him extremely that there was no star to mark the pole. Moody gazed into the fire, the coals of which had long since gone to ash. Thomas Balfour had not told his tale at all chronologically, and his narrative had been further convoluted by countless interruptions, clarifications, and echoes, all chasing one another as endless circles going round. What a convoluted picture it was, and how difficult to see in its entirety! Moody turned his mind to all that he had heard that evening. He tried to place the recounted events into the order in which they had actually occurred. Roughly 9 months prior to the present day, the former convict Francis Carver had successfully cheated Alistair Lauderback out of his ship, the Godspeed. At some point thereafter, and by an unknown complication, he had then lost the shipping crate by which he had forced the politician's hand. Inside this shipping crate was a trunk containing approximately £4,000 in pure gold, a fortune that had been meticulously sewn into the lining of 5 dresses. The seamstress was a woman named Lydia Wells, who was at that time posing as Francis Carver's wife. £4,000 was a great deal of money, and Carver naturally wished to recover it, once he discovered that the thing had been lost. He sailed to Hokitika, presumably guessing that the crate had been delivered there by mistake, and placed an advertisement in the West Coast Times offering a large reward for the crate's safe return. He placed this advertisement under the name of Crosby Francis Wells, producing a birth certificate to confirm this identity, though he was known both beforehand and thereafter by the name of Francis Carver. It was yet unknown why Carver's blackmail of Lauderback had required him, or inspired him, to assume an alias.
It was also unknown why Crosby Wells' birth certificate, if indeed genuine, had been in Carver's possession at that time. The real Crosby Wells, or perhaps, Moody thought, another Crosby Wells, lived alone in the Arahura Valley some miles north of Hokitika. Wells was not a notorious personage, and his acquaintance was small. Before his death he was little known in Hokitika, and those who did know him did not suspect him to be a person of any wealth or consequence. It was Ah Suk, investigating the circumstances of his death 9 months later, who discovered that Wells had made a strike on the fields at Dunstan several years before, pulling in a fortune of thousands of pounds. Evidently Wells had desired, for some reason, to keep this information a secret. Francis Carver placed his advertisement in the Times in early June, the precise month having been confirmed by Benjamin Löwenthal. While in Hokitika, he offered Te Rau Tafare a private reward for any news of a man named Crosby Wells. Tafare did not know a man of that name or description, however, and the shipping crate was not found. Carver returned to Dunedin empty-handed. Anna Wetherill had also arrived in Hokitika upon the Godspeed, clad in a purple working gown rented from her new employer, Dick Mannering. When she learned, some weeks after her arrival, that a trunk containing women's dresses had been salvaged from a wreck, she purchased all five. It was not unreasonable to presume that Anna was ignorant of the fortune these gowns contained, and ignorant also of their origin. She had never spoken of the hidden gold to any man, and she had never attempted in any visible way to remove it. Moody considered this. Was total ignorance really possible? As an opium eater, perhaps she had not noticed the added weight about her person as a sober woman might. Then again, she was, as Gascoigne had attested, a former acquaintance of Lydia Wells, and perhaps she had recognized the garments as Lydia's. Well, Moody thought, whatever the case, Anna had been wearing that entire fortune, a portion at a time, of course, ever since then, save for a month-long period in September and October, when the advanced stage of her pregnancy had compelled her to wear instead a frock designed for lying in. When Anna's landlord, Edgar Clinch, discovered the fortune hidden in the gowns, he concluded that the whoremonger, Dick Mannering, must be using Anna to smuggle raw ore off the goldfields as a way of evading duty at the bank. The thought of this collusion grieved Clinch extremely, but he had no reason to press the matter with either party, and did not do so. Clinch was not the only man to chance upon the hidden fortune in Anna's gowns, however, and he was not the only man to misapprehend its likely meaning. The digger Kui Long had also uncovered the secrets hidden in Anna's seams, around much the same time, in fact, and had leapt to the very same conclusion as Clinch. Ah Kui knew firsthand that Mannering was more than capable of fraud, for he had been cheated by the magnate once before. Ah Kui decided to beat Mannering at his own game. He began siphoning the gold out of Anna's dresses, retorting the dust into squares, and stamping these squares with the name of the gold mine Aurora, so as to ensure that the profit would be banked against his own claim, which by this time had been purchased by a young prospector named Emery Staines. The project of removing the gold from Anna's dress took several months. Whenever Anna visited Arqui's hut in Canieri Chinatown, she was all but senseless with opium. Arqui was therefore able to remove the gold with his thread and needle without her knowledge while she slept. Anna did not wear her orange whoring dress when she travelled to Chinatown. For this reason, the orange dress had remained filled with gold long after Arqui had stripped the other four of their fortune. Nobody knew how or why Arqui's retorted fortune had been stolen from the vault at the camp station. The most probable thief, given the information currently available, was the vanished prospector Staines, who, significantly, lacked a motivation. The young man was colossally rich, and, by popular opinion at least, colossally fortunate. Why should he desire to steal from his own indentured worker? And why should he choose to stash the gold in another man's cottage, so far from his own claims? Well, whatever the young man's reasons, Moody thought, at least one thing was certain. Staines had never banked Arqui's earnings against the Aurora as he was legally obliged to do. This was very perplexing,
for the retorted gold, if banked, would have transformed the Aurora gold mine from a duffer into a homeward bounder overnight. Emery Staines was also very strangely implicated by the deed of gift that Cowell Devlin had discovered in Crosby Wells' stove, which, though it did not bear his signature, bore his name. This deed seemed to imply that Emery Staines and Crosby Wells had been associates of some kind, and that the hoarded fortune had been intended for some reason as a gift from Emery Staines to Anna Wetherill. But this was even more confounding, for whichever way one looked at it, the gold was not Staines to give away. Anna had been carrying a child, Carver's child, since before she arrived in Hokitika, and in the springtime she began at last to show. Her condition was never to fully ripen into birth, however. In mid-October, Carver returned to Hokitika, confronted Anna, and beat her severely. The unborn child did not survive this encounter. Anna's later intimation, when she described the scene to Edgar Clinch, was that Carver had killed the child in cold blood. Moody paused in his chronology to dwell upon this unhappy event. Although the child's death had been referenced in passing several times that evening, it did not seem as though any man present was entirely clear about how this fatal altercation had come about. It was for reasons of natural delicacy that Moody had not pressed the men for further information, but he wondered now how Anna's relations with Carver fitted into the scheme of the story at large. He wondered whether the child's death had truly been intended, and if so, what might have motivated Francis Carver to commit such a heinous act. None of the 12 men currently present could answer this question with any kind of objective certainty, of course. They could only describe what they had been told to be true. How opaque the minds of absent men and women, and how elusive motivation. For Francis Carver might have killed his child in cold repudiation, as an act of loathing, as a brutal prophylactic, or quite by accident. Short of asking the man directly, there was no way to tell. Even Anna Wetherill, who had named Carver as the murderer, might have had any number of reasons to lie. Having reflected upon this, Moody continued. Tirau Taufare, encountering Carver by chance on the morning of the 14th of January, had remembered the offer that the man had made him the previous year. For a price of 2 shillings, Taufare offered to tell Carver where Crosby Wells was living. The men shook hands, Taufare gave directions, and Carver made for the Arahura Valley that very same day, a night that was to be Wells' last. Perhaps Carver had witnessed the hermit's death, or perhaps he had left moments before its occurrence, but in either case he had arrived at the cottage with a phial of laudanum, traces of which were later discovered in Crosby Wells' stomach during his post-mortem. Following their encounter, Carver returned to Hokitika, manned the Godspeed, and weighed anchor, leaving well before the dawn. From Hokitika, Carver had travelled not to Canton, as Balfour had speculated he might, but to Dunedin, a fact that Moody himself could corroborate, for it was at Port Chalmers that Moody had boarded the very same craft 12 days later. Alistair Lauderback, arriving at Wells' cottage soon after Carver departed it, found the hermit dead at his kitchen table, his head resting on his arms. He journeyed on to Hokitika, where he was interviewed by the editor, Benjamin Löwenthal, who was intending to run a political special in Monday's edition of The Times. Löwenthal, hearing from Lauderback that Crosby Wells was dead, deduced that Wells' property would presently be put up for sale. The next morning, he informed the hotelier, Edgar Clinch, of this probable eventuation, knowing that Clinch was looking to make an investment in land. Clinch immediately took his deposit to the bank, where the banker Charlie Frost facilitated his purchase of the dead man's estate. Clinch then commissioned Harold Nielsen to clear the dead man's cottage and dispose of his effects. Nielsen did so, and discovered to his astonishment a perfect fortune hidden in every conceivable hiding place around the dwelling's single room. The ore, once it had been purified by the bank, was valued at a little over £4,000. Nielsen was paid his 10% commission, leaving a little over £3,600. Out of this had been paid sundry death taxes, fees, and incidentals, which included a present of £30 to the banker Charlie Frost. The remainder, still a certifiable fortune, was currently being held in escrow at the Reserve Bank. Clinch was not likely to see a single penny of the sum, however. Lydia Wells, arriving mysteriously from Dunedin some days after the hermit's funeral, had since appealed to revoke Clinch's purchase on the grounds that his property and effects legally belonged to her. Of course, the gold found in Crosby's cottage did not represent the sum total of the fortune at play. Arqui had only stripped 4 out of Anna's 5 gowns. The final portion, sewn into the folds of Anna's orange whoring dress, had been discovered by Anna Wetherill herself but 2 weeks ago, when she woke up in jail following the crisis of her overdose. She had assumed, reasonably enough, that the gold had only just been planted on her person, for she had no memory of what had happened to her in the 12 hours prior to her arrest, and was in a state of considerable confusion. She entreated Gascoigne's help, and together they excavated the metal from the orange gown and hid it in a flour sack under Gascoigne's bed. When Anna then returned to the Gridiron Hotel, wearing the black dress that had belonged to Gascoigne's late wife, Edgar Clinch's old suspicions were renewed. He felt sure, rightly this time, that Anna's change of dress had something to do with the hidden gold, and he noted with bitterness that her orange whoring gown had now disappeared. He resented very much that she claimed to be unable to pay her debts to him, when he knew full well that she was flush with colour. Letting his resentment get the better of him, he spoke to her cruelly and gave her notice to leave. But Clinch's threat did not have the consequence he was expecting. Anna Wetherill had since paid her debt to him in full, but not with the gold in her gowns and not with her legal earnings either. The debt had been paid out that very afternoon by way of a 6-pound loan from Crosby's widow, Lydia Wells. Her debt to Mannering, which by the magnate's reckoning was well over 100 pounds, would be more than covered by the gold she and Gascoigne had excavated from the orange gown. Anna had since quit the Gridiron for good. She had been invited henceforth to take her lodging with Lydia Wells at the Wayfarer's Fortune, where she would no longer call herself a whore. Did Lydia Wells know that Carver's missing shipping crate had ended up in Hokitika, and that the dresses had been purchased by Anna, and that the fortune at Crosby Wells' cottage was one and the same as the fortune with which Carver had blackmailed the politician Lauderback some 10 months ago? Such a question depended entirely upon Anna. How much did Anna know about her own involvement in this very circular affair? And how much, for that matter, was she willing to reveal to Lydia Wells? It was very possible that Anna did not know the dresses had once been Lydia's. In this case, Mrs. Wells would remain ignorant of this fact also,